Hi, I'm Brian, and welcome to the Optimist Roundtable Podcast, Episode 4. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Episode 4. I'm here with Catherine Taylor, Senior Physiotherapist, Clinic Manager at Optimist Health Group. She's a physiotherapist at the Melbourne Vixens, but I'll introduce you and Kath, welcome.
Hello, thanks.
Tell us a bit about your background in physio and where you studied, where you're from, a little bit about your journey to where you got to today.
So I'm English, as the common factor here at Optimus seems to be that we're mostly not Australian, barring KP and Jake who've already been on, so we're getting a bit of the international vibe coming back in. I studied physio in Nottingham in England many moons ago, and then worked post graduation. I worked in a hospital in London at the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, and I worked there for 5 years across rotations. Had a really good learning through those rotations, much though some that I definitely didn't see at the time would have contributed, because I always had this goal that I was going to do sports physio. I don't know if you know this about me, but I thought I was going to be the Liverpool physio, considering you didn't know until recently that I supported Liverpool.
You've been very quiet for the last 5 years.
This is our year. We're going to do it. And then I worked in sport throughout. So I did a sports massage course while I was still at school, and I worked as a soft tissue therapist at Bedford Rugby Club for 4 seasons, so through my whole university degree, and then finished up with them. Was still probably one of the most amazing sport experiences I've had in terms of being part of a team in the first season or two that I was there. And then I graduated, went to London, worked a bit through sport there as well, doing rugby again, and then moved over here. And I've been here for 12 years now, and I've worked in private practice all the time, and then came to Optimus 5 years ago, part-time, and then I've been here coming up for 18 months full-time now as well.
Fantastic.
Been with the Vixens for this is my third season with the Vixens in the team of physiotherapists that we've got providing to them, and I play social netball.
Yeah, cool.
On the side.
What made you come to Melbourne?
There was a boy,
always.
And then when the boy was not on the scene anymore, I'd already been here about 5 or 6 years, and it was home by then.
Yeah.
It's amazing lifestyle, you know, when you're actually interested in sport and culture, it's a really, really great place to be and not get stuck in the logjam of the M25 that is London, and trying to get out of that. Be able to get to beaches in easy driving distance. I've got dogs, you know, the whole purpose of just being able to pop 20 minutes down the road and take them to the beach or head up to the mountains, and, you know, it's easy to get out. It's just a very, very long way away from anywhere in Europe to
anywhere
Melbourne.
That's right. Okay, tell me a little bit more about your studies. Nottingham?
Yeah, Nottingham. So I did my undergrad in Nottingham straight out of school. It was far enough away from home that I had a bit of distance, and not too far actually when I needed a bit of quiet time and do washing. And it was obviously before the internet was as big as it is now, because I'm getting on for dinosaur status. And it was kind of equidistant, so I stayed working at Bedford Rugby Club, so I covered all their game days and did game days as well. So I, throughout my whole years at uni, would go down on a Friday or a Saturday, go down for game day, and drive back either on the Saturday to mum and dad's. And it was kind of equidistant between, like a triangle really, between home, Bedford and Nottingham. And I'd always wanted to be in the city. I grew up in the countryside, so in a small village in, you know, we talk about in England things being the back of beyond, middle of nowhere. Here, that's really not a very far distance, but you kind of don't have that same concept here of villages and that sort of farming community and feeling like you're a long way away. So we had no public transport. There was a bus on market day to the nearest town, so that was once a week. I think have improved now, there's like 3 buses a week. It wasn't great roads to cycle on. There's tractors and lorries, and yeah, it's really really there was nothing happening there for me. I spent most of my childhood being ferried around by my incredibly understanding parents, who took me all over the whole county for various different sports, before school, after school sports, club sports, every single evening, different things every Saturday and Sunday. I did gymnastics growing up, so that involved kind of travel to the nearest city for different kind of trainings and competitions, and that pretty much went all through the year. And then from the age of about 12, I probably started doing multiple other sports as well, which didn't go down quite so well with the gymnastics coaches, because you weren't supposed to focus on other sports. And my time got divided a little bit between hockey, netball, track and field, athletics, and trying my best not to do any form of cross country whatsoever, because much as Melburnians like to complain about the weather, cross country running in England is a different matter entirely.
What's your favourite sport?
So I still play netball. I really like that sort of team sport. It's the participation numbers over here are absolutely massive. I play mixed and ladies still socially. And then just absolutely like passion, just get to work with the girls who are, you know, the best in the world.
Like, yeah, tell us a bit more about the Vixens, because obviously there's a lot of international representatives. Tell us about the league and the team.
So it's really amazing. It's such an exciting time for the sport. You know, Australia's always been recognised up there with New Zealand as being the best in the world. And unfortunately, the results for Australia in the last couple of big events haven't really gone the way that they would have hoped. It's the one sport where I actually support Australia over England, and I never ever thought I'd say that about any sport, and it doesn't happen in any other sport. But I said to the girls last year that when there were five of our Vixens players on the court, I was actually really barracking for them ahead of England. So that was the one thing that turned, because in the Commonwealth Games when England won, I was very happy that England had won, because I think netball in England, and it's huge, like netball became, the English netball team was voted as the BBC Sports Personality Team of the Year, which is absolutely massive, A, for women's sports in terms of where we're going with the professionalism, the level that's being played, the interest in it, people being aware that women's sport is at a good level, and you know, the rise in it. We're obviously super interested in reducing injuries, which I know KP talked about last week, but it kind of is the antithesis to our business, in the sense of we see people who are injured, but we want to stop people from getting injured. It's probably not good for our business plan, but we like to see those sorts of things that are preventable to be prevented and be reduced as much as possible. And the girls and women compete at higher and higher levels and really continue sport participation throughout their life. You know, we see such a drop off in females from their late teens to early 20s, where they have participated in sport throughout childhood, and well, for various different reasons, whether their lifestyle, whether it's access to things, actually just stopping and not restarting. And it doesn't seem to affect male sport in the same way. It's quite interesting.
So we've just had a visitor jump into the studio as well, Whiskey the Golden Retriever. He's got his own Instagram. So if you hear the pants in the background, that's a very happy clinic dog.
And it's not hard to be, but he's definitely more active on Instagram than I am. That is absolutely not the hardest title to achieve in the book. But
talk to me a bit more about social media. So I know that, well, today hopefully will be a topic of learning and continuing professional development.
So actually when you first met me, Brian, I was so anti-social media. I did not have Facebook. I only started back on Facebook 2 and a bit years ago, I think. And then on Facebook and Insta, I joined Twitter longer ago. Again, I was doing some postgrad study. And it was a really good way to get access to articles, get connections to things, just get some of the stuff that I think unless you really spend a lot of time looking, it's quite hard to find up-to-date evidence and find a wide range of it. And I just found it was a bit more easily disseminated by people who I think of as being kind of at the forefront of our profession, whether that's learning from physios or doctors or strength and conditioning coaches. It's just in a really easy formatable, it's easy to find, save it to read later. You know, when you think about it, do it. I'm very much of a, if I hear about something, I actually just want to think about just getting access to that now, and then I'll read it later, otherwise I'll forget.
It's very different to when we studied and access to online journals, isn't it?
100%. And I've not been good enough at kind of setting up Pedro alerts and things, because I know you can do that. But again, then that limits it to whatever you've chosen as your search topic, which, and I still like to keep just on top of what's out there. And you think about, we talk about 7 years from research being published at the best to actually being implemented and being put into practice. And I think there's actually no excuse for that anymore with how accessible it is to get that information. You know, we have early release of information, I'm not sure I should say it, but Sci-Hub as, you know, free access to all journal articles that you could want. Like, it's phenomenal. We don't have to pay thousands of dollars to be able to access these articles that are behind paywalls. And apologies if that gets us into any trouble. The website changes regularly, but you can find it on Wikipedia each time you need it. Yeah. I think that's been absolutely life-changing, because you just get to be able to read the whole article. You can't make a judgment and work out whether something's appropriate to our practice or to the client in front of you until you can read the whole article rather than just the abstract.
Talk to me a little bit more about this, because this is one thing that I feel like a lot of people who might not be as aware as us, that the summary of an article can be very misleading, and quite often is, when you look at things like infographics, and you've got social media influencers who will make very brief summaries, even briefer than the actual summary of the article. Mm. Talk to me about the importance of reading the full article and having some understanding around research to then be able to implement that into practice. And what are your thoughts on those, let's call them influencers.
Yeah.
And the quick summaries that they would project out there, because surely there's a lot of physio students, personal trainers, strength and conditioning coaches, new physios who will have that access to the infographics and action it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's then when you take that as the gospel and what should be done that I think we fall into that sort of tricky ground. I think it's great people are putting information out there, but you have to remember with all of those things, that's their personal subjective choice of what they've put out there. That's what they've picked as the data. They've picked a table. And if you see that out of context and you don't understand what the entire purpose of the study was, you might have chosen to pull numbers out that are actually not relevant to what was being investigated in the study in the first place. It might be an incidental finding that happened, and then you're looking at whether that's actually relevant to the study or that is just an incidental finding, and you make a relationship there when perhaps there wasn't one, or it's not proven to have any power to the study in terms of how it was designed. So when studies are put together and designed, they go through ethics committees. You're really looking at the number of subjects that are in there. You know, if you're looking at something that's got a high volume of people in there versus something that is either a test study put together with 12 people or 10 people, you really need to look at what the adherence rate, the dropout rates are to those. You need to understand how it was designed. Was it blinded? Is there, were they actually using the gold standard as a comparison? Is it a randomised controlled trial? Is it a placebo? Is there, you know, do the researchers themselves have financial interest or have a bias going into the study about it? I had a real, real chuckle listening to the many, many hours of debate on the Joe Rogan show about the Game Changers. And the debate that the guys had on the show was the most interesting part for me, and they carried on for at least 45 minutes about what this one particular piece of data that they were both referencing, and it was one aspect of the numbers showing that there was no significant link between veganism or non-dairy, basically like a non-dairy diet, and cancer. There's no relationship. There was a certain percentage that was positive relationship in terms of that vegan diet reduced the risk of cancer, or non-dairy reduced the risk of cancer, and then there was non-dairy like increasing the risk of cancer. And they were wanting to use the vast majority of that, which was like 60%. They were wanting to use that for both of them. So they were both trying to say that there was like 70 or 80% that was in their favour, because they were both taking that middle of the ground where there was no relationship. They were taking that and just interpreting that however they want. And they were both putting that data out there as, this is how we've interpreted it. And it's wrong. Like, both of them are wrong. When you're looking at something and you're saying there is no relationship, that's to say that you can't say in either way. There is insufficient data to show that. Yeah. And when you just look at something as a number and as a table and you haven't been able to identify everything around that, you can't just listen to what someone else says.
So if you had to give some advice on, say, an infographic that's released through social media, what would your advice be to, say, potentially a new grad, right? We've got Sierra starting with us this week, and if she came to clinic and said, hey guys, look at this, I've just found this shared by such and such on social media, what advice would you give to her?
Great, well found. Look at it, what have you taken from it? But what's the context of it? What basis is it in? And is it the appropriate use of the information from that article? Is it an accurate summary of what was from that article? And is it applicable to the caseload or the person that's in front of you? If you're looking at pulling something out that was on 10 people who were professional ice hockey players, is that relevant to the soccer player in front of you, Brian, who is 24 years old, when these are like 30 plus year old professional ice hockey players? Or, you know, and it's extrapolating the information that's relevant to you, not just picking what you want to see from it.
Would you recommend the student or the new guy going to read the article?
100%.
Yeah. 100%. So if there's no references on it, obviously that's just throw it away.
Yes.
If there's references on it, chase down the references.
Yeah.
And if you're truly interested in it, take, 20 minutes to read the article and just have a look and see.
Read it, analyse it, and then go through their reference list. Look at the articles that they've used as their reference. And are there other things that they've chosen to not use when they're interpreting that and analysing it, and in their discussion what they're working on as recommended talking points?
Yeah.
Have they actually used the best current evidence and used that, or have they just chosen to not discuss it?
Fantastic. So have a look at what the infographics have actually left out in the article, and sometimes that would just be further evidence or further research required, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's so much that we're still really in such an infancy of what we currently practice as physio, and we want to talk about kind of dose-dependent response of things. Even when we're looking at exercise, we still don't know for a specific presentation in front of us for that person of that age with that duration of problem, with, you know, a background of no sports versus someone who's, you know, done recreational sport for 10 years versus someone who doesn't go to the gym. We just don't have enough of that data to be able to apply everything that we have to every single person that we see in front of us. And that sometimes you do have to use the mix of what you perceive to be the best from the information that you've got, but it's not a blanket approach of everyone needs this at this particular dose, everyone needs this surgery, everyone doesn't need this surgery. And I know that's a really interesting thing that we've had conversations about, and I think you've had conversations about with all of us as clinicians here, and we all have our preconceived biases about those things. Like, you said something to me really interesting a few weeks ago, which was this year you wanted to challenge your biases, and I think that's a really positive thing that we all need to do, because the more we practice, the more we get our patterns confirmed by things that we see, but then we continue to see those things. And for me, with my social media, Twitter following, like, I see things that the people that I choose to see follow, and I've chosen to not follow some people, and I'm probably limiting my scope of what I'm learning about because of that.
Bias, isn't
it?
Yeah. So even comes down to social media and the way that social media is structured, is that we will choose who we would like to follow, and then if something goes against our biases and we think, oh, that's bullshit, like that's a terrible article or that's a terrible opinion, and you get more and more of that, you end up unfollowing them.
Yeah, correct. And it really, I think going forward, I think we've all got such a role we want to portray physiotherapy as an excellent profession, and I think for the high majority it is. And we still hear horror stories from clients and from other physios about places that they've worked, experiences that they've had, clients where they've been to other clinics, and you know, what everyone thinks of as physio. I don't think there's any such thing as, oh, I've had physio and it didn't work. I think you've had some input and you've had some treatment, let's call it, and that's been ineffective for you at that point in time. And that's not to say that physio doesn't work. That's not to say that that osteo that you saw was no good and osteo is not great for you, or chiro, or, you know, the personal trainer. Like, it's just at that time, that experience wasn't the right thing for you. And I really try to steer clear from saying negative or derogatory things about other practitioners that people have seen. And I think we have a responsibility to the profession to try and keep people responding to us well and seeing us in a positive light, and as continuing to work together and work move forwards regardless of what our personal opinion might be, because it just upsets me, because you don't know who else is, like, on social media, you don't know who else is reading that, you don't know what they've been going through, you don't know what mental health issues they might have, you don't know how hard they're working, they're doing research studies, they're working full time, they've got a home life, they've had, you know, a personal loss. You just don't understand what people have been going through to understand that a simple comment that you might make, what impact that can have on them. And I know people who have had problems like that on social media, and have had, as physios and as researchers, have had people trolling them and have had serious anxiety and depression issues. I've got quite a few friends working in physiotherapy who have diagnosed or undiagnosed anxiety, depression, mental health issues, and we all see so many people and have so much impact on a personal relationship level with our clients that we take that on board. But I think we don't think about it across our, like, immediate colleagues or across the profession and how it reflects on them.
Yeah. How do you strike a balance? How do you think you strike a balance between being careful with all of those things, but also actually getting good information out? And do you think anyone does it really well?
I think the guys that are doing a lot of the podcasts, like, I do go through phases of listening to podcasts. I think the guys that are doing those are doing really well, because...
Who?
So who I listen to Clinical Edge, David Pope.
Yep.
I listen to Physio Matters. I listen, haven't for a while, to Eric Mirror's podcasts. Who else do I listen to?
What makes those good? What do you really enjoy about those podcasts? Is it the information that's shared, or is it the in-depth discussion that they go through? Because I know, you know, the clinical podcast that I listened to the other day, that was an hour and a half.
Mm.
And so that's, I mean, these podcasts with us at the moment are only 30 to 45 minutes. But what makes them so good, do you think, for a physio and for a practicing clinician?
I think they get experts in their field on, or people that I perceive to be experts in their field and that are putting themselves out there. There might be people that are teaching courses. There might be people doing research. There might be people I haven't heard of sometimes, and that often opens my eyes to make me look at research that they've been involved in or things that they've published. And they actually just allow them, they interview them really well. They, like you've been, and they kind of explore facets of it rather than what I find that none of them do, is they don't project their feelings and their opinions about things onto the people that they're interviewing. So it lets me learn from it in the same way as if I was reading an opinion article or reading a summary piece or going to a course. And in the same way that you go to a course and you've chosen to go on that course, it might be that you've chosen to go and listen to one person, it might be you've chosen to go to a lecture about something, or you might be going to a conference, but you're choosing to go to the things that you go to.
Again, another selective bias, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I think those guys that host those podcasts do it really well in that they let the people talk. And I think one of the ones that Jack Chu on Physio Matters did that I've asked clients to listen to is when he went through the process of having back pain and radiculopathy, and the practitioner who actually had been his boss at the time, she interviewed him about his experiences. And I think it's probably come for me at the same time as I've been a little bit more interested in reading and finding more value in qualitative research studies, because it actually put the focus back on the patient and back on their experience of, even for a clinician and an experienced clinician, of knowing what they were going through. It then put it back into that thing of listening to what people are telling you, what you're taking from the practitioner or the doctor or the referrer or the specialist, what they're telling you, challenging your biases about what you're thinking when someone else is telling you something different, or the experience you're going through isn't what you expect. And he ended up going on to have back surgery, and I 100% don't think that back surgery is for everybody, and he, I think, probably thinks the same as me, but his experience was that he ended up going on to get back surgery. And I've asked some clients who've been in that point where they've had severe radiculopathy, you know, reduced and worsening nerve function and function of their ADLs and worsening pain. I've asked them to listen to it, to just experience what someone who's been through had to say about it and what they thought about the whole process. And that was, I think, really valuable.
So just reiterate that podcast, Who, Why, and...
So that was on Physio Matters, I think it was a few years ago, but that was Jack Chew himself being interviewed.
Yeah.
And he's one of the main hosts. He's, yeah.
Excellent. We'll link that in the show notes, and you can hopefully have a listen to that or share that with your patients if you have anyone who might potentially benefit from that. Sticking on this learning and continuing professional development kind of theme, what are some of the things that you've found from sports perspective? So talking about the Vixens, maybe let's talk a bit about your super rugby experience with the women's, and maybe with the Geo Shield or even at Bedford Rugby Club. What learning and CPD do you think has been the most valuable to you? And then what advice would you give to similar people in a similar situation in those sports teams and sports clubs to go through?
That's really interesting. I think there's no blanket rule to say that the same one thing is right for every individual practitioner if we're talking about physios, whether it's strength and conditioning coaches. I don't think there's any one thing that's right. So I've looked at things that I enjoy. So I like exercise-based treatment. I want people to exercise to get better, because it turns out you have to. You can't just have someone fix you. Revolutionary information.
Dropping bombs.
And I did the ASCA level 1 strength and conditioning a few years back, and I think that's been really helpful for continuing to think about my dose prescription of exercise and loading. But again, a bit of bias confirmation, because I go to the gym and I believe that lifting weights is good for you, but I also do a variety of different exercises. Like, I actually work with GLAD exercises with clients, which is the Scandinavian one that was set up for arthritis. And you know, you'll have people who are completely appropriate with hip and knee issues, that you pull exercises from some of those programs that they might not be designed for, and you actually just have a broad repertoire of things and don't limit yourself to any one thing of thinking, oh, if you're playing contact sport, you've just got to lift heavy to be ready for those heavy things. You actually need to have a really broad ability to prepare and rehabilitate your players, particularly for any and all of the training in the gym, cross training they might be doing. You know, if someone's got terrible shoulder strength or spatial awareness, proprioception, how are they going to go with their gym and strength program, let alone their conditioning, whether it's boxing, running, rowing? You need to prepare them and actually be aware of everything that is incorporated with them. And I think particularly it's really lucky when you look at elite sport level, because you can focus on that. But when we're looking at the everyday athlete, whether they're playing community level sports, whether that's Geo Shield, whether it's, you know, playing recreational sport or going for a run, you've then got to factor in what they're doing in the rest of their life as well, and the fact that their sport participation is a much smaller percentage of their time. And some people that will be a high priority, and for some people it's not. And I think the challenge for me when I've looked at doing courses has been how to take my passion and my learning, whether it's about how much work they have to put in with tendinopathy rehab, and then that's someone who's only playing, you know, 2 hours of community sport on a weekend, and if they're lucky getting to one training session a week, how I can really tell them that they need to spend 10 hours a week doing specific strength training and rehab. But I find that quite quite a challenge that I enjoy with trying to get people to be brainwashed and see it from my point of view.
So effectively, that's a good physio day, brainwash your patients to
100%.
Do what's required.
I always joke to them. Yeah, I joke to them that it's a dictatorship and they do what I tell them. But I actually also have conversations with my clients about how I find it really interesting how little of the time people ask you why you're asking them to do something. And it happens, like, out of the clients that I would see, it happens less than twice a day of and whether it's because I've explained it without realizing, but very rarely will people ask us why we're doing something, let alone why we're asking them to do something. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that we have to be more happy and prepared to educate people on about why they're doing. And I feel like we do that quite well here at Optimus. I think people get that buy-in and our clients come back to us and see us because they're aware they're a part of that decision making, rather than me joking and saying it's a dictatorship. And, you know, you're going to do this exercise and this is what you're going to do. But the only way you can get people to do that is by giving them the why, giving them the reason why and what it's going to enable them to do, and show that you're working together towards their goals. And I think all of the things that you do with your ongoing professional development, that has to facilitate that. Because you might be the smartest person in the world. You might know the most amount of information. If you can't communicate that or get that rapport with your clients, they're not going to do it. They're not going to understand why, but they're just not going to do it.
Yeah. And sometimes they have to do things that they don't enjoy in order to get back to doing the things that they love.
100%.
And so it's really important to be able to link those two together.
100%. And to be able to tell them it's boring. Like, you know that some of those basic exercises are boring as all get out. They're not fun.
Yeah.
But you have to give that bigger picture of being able to go, okay, well, this is for this amount of time, and then we're going to be able to do that.
How do you think new grad clinicians can learn how to do that?
Oh, it's the challenge, I think, and we've had those conversations with a couple of the guys that have worked with us through their studies. People come out and there's so much information on social media about this is what you shouldn't do, this is what you should do, you've got to do X, Y, and Z, you've got to do this. Like, you're going to get it wrong.
Yeah.
You're going to read things, work out how you can apply it. You just have to get that time of building up the time and having the support to be able to reflect on those things and having formal and informal systems in place. I think if you don't ever reflect on your practice, you're not going to improve. And that doesn't have to be completely critical formal. Sometimes you've got to look back and go, oh, that went really well. Why did that go well? And when I try and do reflective practice with some of the staff here, often the first thing they'll say is, oh, what should I have done differently? What should I have done better? I'm like, hold on. What did you do that went really well? And actually, well done for that. That's a great process to have. You did this, you reassured them, you covered these bases. And yeah, what else is there that you could do differently? And maybe there wasn't anything that you would have done differently at that time. I think a lot of the time there will be. As a new grad, it's working out, you know, they haven't got pattern recognition. They haven't got the experience of having seen 100 knees over their career or, you know, 20 shoulder dislocations and through the different things. And it's just starting to recognize how to prioritize those things. And again, it comes in through clinical reasoning of what is your primary hypothesis? Keep it simple. What's your secondary hypothesis? How are you going to prove or disprove those things? Don't try and cover everything all at once. Sit back at the end of each day, at the end of each week, reflect on what you did. What do you want to do in the next session? Don't beat yourself up too much. Make sure you're safe. Do the simple things. Start doing the simple things well, and don't try and add too much bullshit into it.
I think you just dropped about 20 bombs there. That would be fantastic advice for any new grad. So, good work. Thank you very much, Kat. Just starting to wrap things up, who would you recommend following regarding that learning and CPD? And other than those podcasts that you've mentioned, are there any particular people? Is there any particular journals that you recommend people subscribe to? It doesn't have to be clinical.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So I think things like Physio Network, isn't it? So I actually don't follow them. But I think some of those things where you've got a lot of industry leaders who are doing their analysis of different articles, which it's good to read. It's good to read how other people have interpreted things. But I think some of that is just good to get that kind of generalist awareness and start to look at what other people are reading and talking about. I think I'm not the best person. KP told you a whole load of people last week. I'm sure Brian will in future weeks because he's very good at social media.
I
often look at a lot of things that he retweets. And I know that I, as a bias, kind of follow people that I've gone to conferences of. So I've gone to some of the SMA conferences. I've gone to, through some of the postgrad study through La Trobe. So I follow all the guys that work out of La Trobe Sports and Exercise Medicine Research Centre, because that's absolutely world leading. You know, Christian Thorborg, the guys working out of London, the guys working out of Doha, the guys at Aspetar. BJSM, I have a huge publication bias towards. I'll sit and look at their site and look at their most recent articles that are published online.
Highly recommended, yeah.
Okay. But again, feeds back into our biases of how we think.
Well, what I'll do, I will get a list from you and I'll pop them in the show notes. Take a look at last week as well. I've popped all of KP's stuff in the show notes and Jake in week two as well. What would you like to see in future podcasts, and what would you listen to here?
Well, I would always listen to you talk, because I think you're very interesting to listen to with your experiences, so you definitely need to be the subject of one of them.
I will be soon. We'll be shortly.
And then I really don't know. That's right.
Not sure?
I don't know. I just like listening to things that I perhaps wouldn't necessarily pick to listen to otherwise.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see what guests we can get on in the near future, and if anyone listening does have any requests, please do follow us on Facebook or Instagram, it's the Optimus Health Group account. I'll pop a link to your Twitter as well, Kath, and thank you very much for your time and your thoughts, especially around that learning and CPD and biases. So really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man.